Hello, I am Melanie McGuinn, and you're welcome to Let's Talk About Sociology of Education. Hello, and you're very welcome along to Let's Talk About the Sociology of Education. I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor Aileen Kennedy, who is Director of Teacher Education in the University of Strathclyde in the School of Education there. Aileen, you're very welcome along.
Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to have you here. So would you like to just tell us a bit about yourself, your role and your career to date, and any connections and interests you have in the sociology of education?
Okay. So I started off professional life as a primary teacher, teaching in the west of Glasgow, and I became increasingly interested in issues around equity, fairness, well, more importantly, I became interested in issues around discrimination and unjust workings in school. And I started to study part-time for a postgraduate diploma in equality and discrimination. And I became increasingly unsatisfied with the working in school, in that school that I was in, because I felt that there was kind of a suggestion that teachers should be in their classes and that's all they do, whereas I wanted to do more than that. And so I thought I might try and work in another school. So I read the paper, as you did then, to look for jobs, and found a job advert for the General Teaching Council, and was young and naive, so applied for that and ended up getting this post. So that took me more into the national scene. And I was really fortunate to be supported there to do my MEd, where I kind of grew that interest in power. And so I suppose my story is about an unintentional foray into the sociology of education. I think it found me rather than I found it. So I was interested in issues around teachers and power and power dimensions and how policy shapes all of this. And I then went for the first time to work at the University of Strathclyde, where I worked for 15 years. And then in 2015, I moved over to, huge move, all the way to the east coast of Scotland, less than 50 miles, to the University of Edinburgh. And I will talk later about the work I did there, because that's been a career highlight for me in terms of what I was allowed to do around creating a completely new teacher education programme. But in August of last year, I came back to the University of Strathclyde, in part because that's where I suppose my heart was, but also in part because it is the biggest provider of teacher education in Scotland, one of the biggest in Europe. Every year we graduate over 1,000 teachers. And so the challenge of scaling up some of the social justice work that I was doing at Edinburgh was for me the attraction of coming back to Glasgow. It's also, now that I'm here, it's one of the massive challenges and the, I wouldn't say a fear, but I'm conscious that it's a big thing to be able to do, to make big changes in that level of preparation. So I guess aside from that, the thing that actually I talk to my students about when we talk about understanding ourselves and our privileges and disadvantages, that, and I didn't think this was relevant until fairly recently, but I am a farmer's daughter, and I would say that my farming background and how I learned or didn't learn about class and privilege actually has had quite a big influence, unexpectedly for me until fairly recently. That's probably enough just now before I give you an entire autobiography.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's interesting. It's always good to, get the back story, as to how somebody got to where they are as well. So thank you for that. So you're based in the University of Strathclyde now. So you're in Scotland. Mm-hmm. So the Scottish initial teacher education system has some similarities and commonalities with the Irish system, but there are also some differences as well. So do you want to briefly kind of give an overview it's a huge system, so just an overview as such of the Scottish IT system, just for the listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways it's relatively easy because it's pretty well regulated and similar across Scotland. So all our teacher education is university based. Since the late 80s, it was all degree based. Up until maybe the early to mid 2000s or 2010s, we pretty much had two routes to becoming a teacher. You could either do a 4-year undergraduate or a 1-year postgraduate diploma or professional graduate diploma, as it is for us now. And then the First Minister had put out a call for what he was calling innovative routes, which were responses from the 11 providers. So we have 11 university providers. At that point, we only had 9. We now have 11. A call out to us to try to design teacher education programmes that might meet particular challenges. And those challenges were really quite varied. So there were things like recruitment challenges around particular geographical areas and particular subjects, something that's, I think, recognised the world over. Underrepresentation of certain groups in teaching, a desire to, on the one hand, up to master's level, and on the other hand, get people in more quickly. So, and returning to teaching, so how might we get people who had left or drifted back into teaching? So a whole package of things that have actually resulted in some quite different routes, which for us in Scotland has been quite unusual. I suppose the other key thing is that we've had a General Teaching Council since 1966, and the General Teaching Council is responsible for accreditation of all ITE, theoretically on behalf of government, and they also are the gatekeepers of the professional standards, which obviously frame what we do in ITE. So there will probably be other contextual things that I will either I'll remember to bring up, but please prompt me if that's necessary. But I think there'll be other things might arise as we carry on our chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so absolutely. And thank you for that. And again, it's just good to get context. We have obviously Teaching Council here in Ireland as well, but it's a newer, it's newer than certainly than 1966 in Scotland. Okay, so Aileen, as with all the guests on the podcast, I asked everyone that's coming on it to come up with a title. One of the objectives of the podcast is to try demystify what sometimes can be seen as kind of abstract and dense sociological theories and make them real. So the title you've come up with is Social Justice in ITE, Moving from Aspiration to Enactment. So would you like to elaborate a bit for the listeners on what exactly that means and why you chose that title?
Yeah. So I think pretty much everyone I speak to, certainly in Scotland and in many other countries across the globe, would say our ITE really promotes and is based on a view of social justice as being either being important or as being central. And I'm not actually convinced that that is the case. I think that is the aspiration, and I'm very, very pleased that that's the aspiration. And certainly it wasn't the aspiration maybe 10, 20 years ago. And this was one of the things when I started working on developing the new programme that I was responsible for at Edinburgh, that I was really keen to think about how we could see social justice in ITE rather than just teach discrete classes about it. So I guess for the student listeners, this is probably helpful actually in terms of thinking about how their courses are designed and why they feel the way they do or why they don't feel other ways. And I think for people who are maybe teacher educators, I think it is undoubtedly an issue that for all of us we probably wrestle with constantly. So I personally have been keen to move from aspiration to enactment, and I'm keen that our students are able to explain what that means, that they're able to see not just how they teach through a social justice lens, but how they learn through a social justice lens. So I'm not going to claim to have cracked it, and that's so unfortunately not what I'm going to be able to share with you today, But I think it is, for me, an exploration of how we use the really good research that I suppose, to be really blunt about it, tells us that social justice is a way of being, as well as a set of knowledge and information and potentially pedagogical approaches. So yeah, it's about that all-encompassing, how do we actually do it? Let's be brave. Let's not just say we're going to do it. Let's think about how we might do this.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's you know, as in with lots of things of sociology, so it's kind of like our positionality as well, isn't it? Like how we position ourselves and what lenses we choose to look through. Sometimes we don't always look through all the windows. We look through the one we're most comfortable with, maybe, and we don't look at the others, you know. So social justice is all encompassing. And, you know, it can be challenging, though, Aileen, for student teachers, I think, as well, to kind of position themselves. It's difficult for teacher educators, difficult for schools, principals, students, teachers as well. So it's a great title, and it's something, you know, that we could talk for a long time about. So staying with the whole concept of social justice and research, so what does the research tell us about social justice in ITE and how that might impact on students' outcomes?
So it's probably fair to say that this is not just a Scottish issue, but politically, the disadvantage of certain groups is prioritised at different times. And to exemplify that from a Scottish context, we have had for very many recent years a massive emphasis on poverty and a huge national programme to attempt to close the poverty-related attainment gap. And so there has been a plethora of research which indicates which groups of young people are less likely to achieve in school, and then attempts to try to mitigate through how we organise and deliver our teaching. But I think it's cyclical in that now, and particularly on the back of the Black Lives Matter movement, but I think now in Scotland there's much more, even just in the last couple of years, much more explicit awareness among stakeholders of issues of race equality and discrimination. And so the kind of research that is out there in the education sphere is very much more now focused on outcomes for Black and minority ethnic young people. So I think what I'm saying in that respect is that there's so much sociological research out there that we can always find something to support whatever particular prioritisation is, you know, in, well, I guess principally in political favour. So there's all of that research that in some ways, probably, this is me going out on a limb actually and saying what I think rather than what I absolutely know, that I don't think it's that research that necessarily informs our priorities in education. I think that's research that we then go to draw on when other social issues emerge. So there will be people out there who can unpack that influence, you know, what influences what and then what responds to what. But for me, there's always research that we can draw on that explains very clearly that if you do this or you don't do this, these groups are more or less likely to be advantaged or disadvantaged. And I mean, it's been quite interesting actually just thinking about how things have changed through the pandemic, unintentionally, thinking about parent friends of mine whose children go to school with my son or, you know, his contemporaries. There are a couple of people that have spoken to me about the fact that their children have never liked being at school. They don't like the structures they find, particularly children, for example, with autism, who are terribly uncomfortable in this mainstream setting, who've loved learning at home, who've thrived. Now, and I appreciate not everyone has the home environment that is possible in, but this idea, you know, that we're pro-social justice, we're constantly working to get better outcomes for learners, but actually what these things have shown us very clearly are that we need to do something more than tinker with our delivery, that actually this is hugely structural. So I may be wandering a bit here, but I guess there's all of that research, and then there's the research that I'm particularly interested in terms of research that informs teacher education pedagogy. And there's a whole host of work that I find, I suppose, broadly speaking, critical pedagogy, I would say, is the kind of framing way that I would come in. And that's something that I love talking with my students about, because I can talk about how it frames my work with them in a way that they can then interpret how that frames their work with their children and young people. So making these things explicit, making your pedagogical decisions explicit with your students is a great way to share issues and perspectives. So critical pedagogy, I suppose for me, other areas of research that I find incredibly influential would be around transformative learning, culturally responsive pedagogy, professional activism, etc. And again, I think these are things that can be applied to teacher education pedagogy and to school learning pedagogy.
Okay, so and I'm familiar with some of the work you've done yourself on those areas, and you know, I suppose one of the challenges in initial teacher education, Aileen, for us all is trying to fit it all in, because you know, whether our students are on a consecutive program or a concurrent program, time and credits kind of tend to dictate maybe how we operate and how we, you know, cover the material. But a big thing, you know, for us is having the time to think, and the students having the time to think as well and process this, you know, because, you know, when I think back to my student teacher days, I actually loved sociology of education. I did PE and Irish, and I loved the sociology of PE and all that, but not everybody does. So I might have been thinking about it. I'm not saying I was thinking about it at a really high level, I wasn't, but I was thinking a bit. But others, you need time to think and process, you know, what these things mean. And sociology of education is broad, you know, as well. So, like, do you find that a challenge to try and capture, say, within a semester or within a module or a couple of modules or something for the students?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess you wouldn't expect me to say, no, we do it. it absolutely is. Yeah. And it's like everything else in both the ITE curriculum and in the school curriculum, that things are fighting for space and place. And I suppose added to that is that in Scotland, we have moved, maybe not recently, but certainly since. So when I did my BEd in the late 80s, early 90s, we did what was more obviously disciplinary learning around philosophy, sociology, psychology, etc. That's become much more integrated, I would say, across our ITE, across Scotland. So actually teaching sociology in an ITE programme is quite a difficult thing to identify sometimes in all of our courses. And so for me, it is about how we do that, how we create a programme that is sociologically informed in a deliberate way, because I guess they all are informed, but maybe we don't always think about how and why. And the work that I say allowed to do in Edinburgh actually did allow us to build something that started from first principles. And it was, I would have to acknowledge, it was because we had a head of school there who had a vision and was brave enough to fight for that vision to be realised, and yeah, be forever grateful to her for that context to be able to work in. So she wanted me to lead something that was master's level, graduated students to teach across the primary, secondary sector division, which may not be a big issue, I'm not sure, for you in Ireland, but here that's just not what we do. And that it should have an absolute social justice Yeah, that's what it was about. So totally appealed to me, and I started working up ideas for what I was calling an MSc in activist learning and teaching, but it seems that the word activist wasn't entirely popular in the university community. You know, the connotations of flag waving and protests, which was clearly, you know, I was drawing on Judith Sack's work, but my colleagues perhaps in the sciences and engineering and medicine, maybe it was a bit of a tall order for me to expect them to engage with that work. So we ended up, actually, this sounds like a back to front way of doing it, but we ended up calling the programme Transformative Learning and Teaching. And it was at that point that I really engaged deeply with the work around transformative learning, and obviously starting with Jack Mesereau. But I was very taken with Ted Fleming's work, who is a local for you, and the politics of recognition. And that really informed for me how we would engage with all the partners we worked with. So that includes the students, but also includes the school communities and people in the university more widely. And so partly the naming of the programme was something that we sought to attract people who were interested in thinking about that as being core to being a teacher. And the interviews we did with people to get onto that programme were utterly fascinating, because we were attracting people who didn't just want to be teachers, they wanted to be teachers through an explicit social justice lens. They had a commitment. One of the things that we were absolutely clear about at interview was that they must have some awareness of the power of the teacher and the capacity for teachers to engage with communities and actually to advocate for justice and to make change. From the very outset with these students, I was learning from them and with them. And we absolutely had built the programme around genuine student-centeredness, such that we asked them to negotiate what the assessment tasks would be. So we only ever had learning outcomes and dates, because the university needs dates for grades. But it was just, yeah, I am rabbiting here because I love that whole experience with them. And it was founded on the idea that we cannot teach about something if we're not prepared to teach in that way.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. You know, it's lovely to get those examples as well. And I know, like in our teaching now, and I know in my own sociology, because we have it as a discrete module, so I coordinate, but other people teach with me on it, and we you know, we approach it as a team. But we've gone a UDL route with the assessment as well for the students, so giving them the opportunity to choose how they present their work, you know, and it kind of, it's really changed how they think about it. You know, they don't, and as you say, every student wants to know, how much do I have to write? When do I have to have it in? And when will I get my grade? So it's more about, they see themselves in it. There's a bigger ownership maybe for them, you know, in it overall as well. And certainly, you know, it's the democratic piece, but it's also that social justice agenda. So it's nice to hear, you know, say in another jurisdiction, how that has worked. So Aileen, like working through your research then, because obviously I know you've done a lot of research on the programmes you've worked on as well, but you've lots of other research there as well. Is there any big, really big piece that you want to kind of reflect in terms of aspiration to enactment, social justice in IT? Which are the big pieces of research of your own work that kind of come to mind?
I suppose that's quite a difficult one to answer, because for me, I genuinely do believe that my research and teaching are totally integrated. And very often my research is actually a reflection on my teaching rather than my research informing my teaching. I think it does both. But I suppose a couple of things, or maybe three brief things in response to that. One would be work that I did very early on in my academic career, so actually in my PhD, around trying to conceptualise different models of professional learning. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I did use the term transformative, and I would, this is terrible to admit this now, but it's also about the honesty of how we all are as learners, but I had not engaged with all the work around transformative learning at that stage. I was using it, I suppose, as a proxy for change, good change, however one might define that. But actually, when I looked back, I could see how I had come to that, because it was through that whole interest in power and policy, professional learning policy, and how it shapes how teachers engage with their work and with others, and indeed with the young people. So that for me, I suppose, has been, again, an unintentional but enduring theme. Then there's some of the work that I have done around that programme in Edinburgh, and particularly some work that I've done with my students, and actually presenting with them and using them to sense check my own views on, because I can give a very romantic, poetic view of the work we did in that programme. Not that, I mean, I can also share some of the challenges and pain, but it was important to me that if we were teaching in this way as a community who respected each other and tried to work on democratic principles, that it would be inappropriate for me to just research on these students, and that actually to work with them has been enlightening for me in particular. And more recently, what I'm working on at the moment is a Scotland-wide project in 6 years, funded by Scottish Government, involves all 11 ITE providers, and it's called Measuring Quality in Initial Teacher Education. And the crux of that is that measurements that tend to exist out there and that you can read about in the literature are terribly contextually bound and sometimes quite limited. So what we're trying to do in this research is to find a way of not so much measuring, but identifying quality and doing that in a way that is about what quality means to us in Scotland, but also acknowledging that while we might have a common understanding of that, actually we will all have slightly different perspectives on it. And one of the fascinating things about that work has been how it has grown over the piece. So we're in year five now, and how our conversations with government colleagues have become much more honest. And so we sit and pore through the data together and look for explanations. And it's one of these things that I think, especially when you're first being introduced to research, you think it tells you a thing and that's what it tells you. And actually, this process of checking out different interpretations, but doing that firsthand with other stakeholders, I totally love it. It is why I would bother researching. There's no point in researching if it's not going to make a difference. But actually, this whole process, I think, is making a difference. And I think it's my equivalent of classroom-based practitioner inquiry, that we're doing things that matter to us. We're trying to collect data in systematic ways, but we're also conscious that it needs to be relevant and proportionate to the context. So, yeah, that's my current...
hobby. Yeah, and you know, I'm listening to you as well, and I'm thinking it's important, and sometimes we don't document this enough, that we document and catalogue how we do research, you know, as teacher educators, as practitioners in that space, and work with others. So like I'm currently working on a big national project on teacher induction, and you know, we had to truncate it because COVID got in the way, mm-hmm. but we had to change it around a bit as well. And like that, Aileen, trying to understand, you know, why we're getting the responses we are and what they might mean and what they don't mean, but also the methodological decisions we're making in our interpretation as we do that. So, you know, like we had started with an SLR, we used a Brown and Clark framework in that, we've moved it on, we're kind of at the end of it or nearly now, but again, that iterative piece, you know, and why, and then all the decisions we make along the way, and that's where the learning really is. And I'm like you, I get, you know, sometimes I probably get too excited about it, but something will come to you and you're kind of thinking, why is that like that? Or why did they come back at it that way? Or where is that stakeholder coming from? So it's the perspectives piece as well. So I can imagine, you know, again, like with all the IT providers in Scotland, that you get a diverse, set of viewpoints and you know, opinions and ways of doing things. You know, so it is that kind of the lived experience of people and the responsibility on researchers, I think, is huge to represent those lived experiences, you know, thereafter. So I can imagine. And that's a longitudinal study that you're involved in, is it?
Yeah. Which is great to be able to do because there's so little funding around for that kind of work. And we're hopeful as we come towards the end of that, that there is sufficient there for us to build something else on. It would just, the longer you invest in it, the more you feel sad at the prospect of not really milking it for everything we can possibly get from it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And all we'll the nuggets. See. Yeah, no, I understand. Mm-hmm. And again, and it's you become very attached to it because you live it
absolutely.
As well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose moving back again into the IT, the students, you know, that you work with as well, and describing mainly, you know, how the theories and concepts from sociology of education might manifest in everyday practice or day-to-day practice for the student teacher. So student teachers have the university setting and they also have the practicum piece as well. And sometimes there can be a disconnect between, you know, what we cover with them maybe at university level and when they go to school. And sometimes, in fact, they'll tell you themselves, you know, you go to a school, we've given them plenty and we've worked with them on pedagogy, and then when they go into a school, that's not the way things are taught in that school, so they have to kind of adjust on the fly. So how do you see maybe them making connections in the practicum?
I think there is a need for teacher education designers or developers actually to be a bit more explicit about why things are the way they are, in order that everyone involved, so we have a very big focus on partnership in Scotland, but we know particularly from that the MQuite study research that the university teacher educator's view of partnership is much more rosy than the students, which is much more rosy than the school mentors. So we know that even though we think we have national systems, actually they are considered and felt to be different actually by different parties. So I think one thing for me is that if we can make more explicit how we expect connections to happen because of the way we've deliberately set up the programme, that actually does help. So I suppose a real example would be decisions about planning, for example. So schools understandably want students to come with a pro forma, a planning pro forma, that they can understand, know how it works, use year after year, use with students from Strathclyde, from Glasgow, from Edinburgh, from Aberdeen, and they don't want variation. Now, I totally understand that. But when we've tried with a group of students to build planning up from the ground to get them to think about what would you plan and why, and what do you need to know and what kind of processes would you use before we got to the administrative bit of what a plan looks like, that has actually caused angst for everybody because people are looking for different things. Now, when that angst got very angsty and we actually got everyone together and said, this is why we're doing it, it was people were much more willing to go with it, and the students were more content to feel confused by it with the reassurance that they would get there. So, I mean, that's maybe the planning example. You know, it's not directly related, I guess, to the theme of our discussion, but I think it's a nice concrete example of how we we can expect, you know, we've built an amazing programme. It looks great. Look at that integration between university and school. But if we haven't done any more than block out where the students are, then, you know, I don't know how we can hope for it to be anything else. I also think that a direction that I'm really keen to push even more is that we don't talk about university and then placement as school experience, or teaching practice, even worse. That idea that we're teaching you things at university and then you go out and practice it in school, and then someone will come out and watch you demonstrate or perform and give you a performance mark. I mean, I think it's just, it takes away any sense that we've actually got a pedagogical rationale for what we're doing. So I think the idea that we are all clear that we're learning in these different sites. So we're learning in university and we're learning in schools. And we may be practicing things, because practicing is part of learning, but it's not that we learn in university and practice in school. And I think it makes these points where students inevitably feel the conflict of what they have heard or understood in university and then what seems to be happening and being expected of them in school. It just makes it so much easier to cope with that, because that's about learning about context and why different people have different views and where these have come from and what policies shape or don't shape and where the wiggle room is. So I think it's incumbent on us as teacher educators to be much more explicit about how the links could or should work. And I'm not suggesting that that would mean that, you know, we teach about social justice and then it all happens. But I think it certainly is a way to go towards it. It also respects the student teachers as learners rather than recipients of information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, with that theme of social justice, it's more democratic, you know, approach and a process, and the learner autonomy. And that's obviously coming from your transformative learning, you know, underpinning there as well, you know, and that transformation, which is iterative, you know, that's iterative over time. Here we have moved from, we call it school placement now, or it's, well, since 2014. In actual fact, we're about to go into another round of reaccreditation shortly. And, you know, to try and get everybody conceptually to move from teaching practice, which is, as you've described, nearly, it's the apprenticeship model, nearly the mechanistic, write my lesson plan, teach my class, do my evaluation, next lesson plan, please. It's the immersion in the school, and it's all the additional pieces from the ground up and the learning, as you say, that goes, you know, with that. So we have gone there. There are still people who consider the teaching practice, the just the classroom related stuff, to be kind of the front and centre. But there's, you know, certainly I think it's well embedded here at this stage that we've gone to that school placement. The other challenge you reminded me of when you talked about it is different providers have students in schools on placement at different times or at the same times, but we operate with different, I suppose, requirements, even though we're all accredited by the Teaching Council. So that's very frustrating for a school.
Absolutely.
Incredibly so. So you've reminded me of that, that we're not the, you know, obviously you've moved to try and come to some kind of consensual, you know, piece around that, and that you can have some shared approach at least to it. That's probably something we need to do as providers here, for the, you know, it's so difficult to take student teachers in, to allocate them classes, to allocate them mentor teachers, cooperation teachers, and then they come to you and they have four different types, you have four students and they've got four different requirements. So that's a challenge, you know, huge challenge, you know, overall. So we've a bit of work to do, I think, on trying to sort that part of it as well. And I suppose one other thing that comes to mind, you talk about the assessment piece of it, and the assessment on school placement, and again, the social justice piece. So within the Scottish system, the mentor teacher has a role to play in the assessment. So would you mind even just describing that just briefly? Because our mentor teachers don't actually play a role in assessment per se. They certainly, they mentor the student and they act as a cooperating teacher, but they don't actually play a part in the assessment.
Yes, so across Scotland, we would generally be saying that what we're seeking to do is to have tripartite discussions after an observation of teaching, and that the final assessment would generally be something that should be a collaboration between the university tutor and the teacher mentor. So that's the baseline expectation and probably reality across most of Scotland. The model that we used in the course that I spoke about in Edinburgh actually was quite radically different from that. And I'm thinking about that as I'm hearing you talk about, you know, maybe more similarity across courses is better for the school. But then I'm thinking, well, that stops you doing things that are pedagogically different. So, yeah, and I'm not sure where I stand on that, because I want all of these things. I want it to be as easy as it can be for the school, but as radically exciting and well-informed as it could be in design. But what we did away with the idea, we did away with the term placement. We spoke about site-based learning, and we had students out in groups in clusters of schools where they got to know the whole community and all the schools in it. They got a lot of observation and feedback, but very much coaching and written feedback from teacher mentors and local tutors, ourselves and their peers. But actually, we didn't grade them at all on placement across the 2 years until the very end. And all our teachers are assessed against the standard for provisional registration, the GTC standard. And usually that's by observation, and actually half of it you can't observe. So, you know, it's not a genuine reflection against the standard. But what we asked our students to do was to collect evidence over the 2 years and come to us at the end of the 2 years and say, I do meet the standard and here's my evidence. And they provide us with a portfolio, and then we had a professional viva, which involved a school person and a university person. So that was difficult for schools, because that isn't how anyone else works. And I was really conscious of that. We were asking people to do something quite radically different that felt wrong to many of them. And I could talk and talk and talk about that. And actually the whole assessment side of teacher education fascinates me, but maybe that's for another episode.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and again, I suppose even thinking on the sociology end of it, I mean, all schools are different as well. There'll be similarities, but from a social justice perspective, even with schools, there can be differences, you know, in who attends schools, the profile of the schools, the supports that the school has. So there's a myriad of experiences for the student teachers there as well. And there's a whole equity based thing there to think about. So it's all connected. Mm. All these things do, you know, they do all connect back in. So Aileen, I suppose we're coming close to the end of this episode now. And again, it's something that I've asked other contributors, because we can't not ask it, is around the pandemic and how that has impacted, you know, on kind of sociology within teacher education. So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I suppose the biggest learning, I think, not just for student teachers, actually probably for all of us involved in school education, is that it has given us a window into advantage and disadvantage in a way that we would never have had. Now, I'm not sure, I think it's positive in terms of actually being able to see it. I think it's terrible in terms of what it's surfaced. But I think our students have been very easily able to see in real ways how certain groups of children and young people and families have been privileged through the pandemic, and the ways that we maybe hadn't even thought about, in which others that we theoretically knew were disadvantaged, but actually we could ignore it because it was just, oh, they're not doing so well in the class. But actually, now that it is about, well, it's not even just about access to learning, it's actually about, it's brought to the fore, I think, more readily, the importance of well-being and the active role of the teacher in that, and the need for the teacher to understand social demographics and to be able to connect at a basic level with their pupils. But actually, I'm just thinking, one of the positive things has been, in many cases, the connection with families that I hope endures, because I think there has been, as well as huge disadvantage, there has been a levelling in some ways as well. So seeing your child's class teacher in their own living room is a leveller. It makes them seem more approachable and more normal, for want of a more appropriate word. So I think we've watched things that we might generally only have learned about in sociology in a way that I suspect will be enduring for these teachers' careers, actually.
Yeah, that's interesting, even to think in terms of the access that teachers have to pupils' homes and parents' homes, and equally that's reciprocated in that the students can see their teacher working from home and teaching at home, and their dog or cat, or you know, I suppose it's what you say, like it's kind of you know, that there's more similarities and commonalities there than maybe people thought, you know, initially. So and that's reassuring for people as well, you know, because obviously the pandemic has been horrific for lots of people, and everyone has suffered in some shape or form, but it's the connection that technology has enabled has probably bolstered resilience in some way, you know, that they can connect in, and the isolation piece can probably be addressed, you know, a little bit as well. So and there's pieces of it we'll probably take with us, you know, if we ever get out of it.
We will
Yeah, and there's pieces of it we leave behind as well, for sure and certain. But and from a sociology of education perspective, there are other inequities and inequalities there that have been kind of, you know, they've been made worse, you know, during it. But but it's been good. I you know, if you look at it like the sociologist, you can see things maybe a lot more defined than they were, a bit murky maybe before. And as you say, we didn't have to deal with them. They were those uncomfortable conversations that we didn't want to have or need to have or didn't have time to have because we were so curriculum driven, you know. So I think that has been useful as well. So okay, so I suppose final thoughts then over to you, Aileen, just in terms of your title, Social Justice and IT, Moving from Aspiration to Enactment. Any final thoughts there for the listeners? Where to from here?
Yeah, I think one final thought for the listeners who are currently student teachers is the message from me is that enactment can't ever be something that we as teacher educators just deliver, and that these student teachers should feel entitled to be part of that enactment and to have these conversations with us, with the other stakeholders, with school partners. And an enactment will only ever be something that is driven by the whole community. So you have more power at your disposal than you maybe think is my final message.
Absolutely, and you can co-construct, you know, that to get to that outcome. So okay, Aileen, it's been lovely talking to you. It's been really interesting, lots for us to think about there. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk About Sociology of Education. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share it with someone you think might like it. There will be a new episode coming soon.